Adler Belge, given anomaly, that's a situation when you have some symmetry classically, but when you try to figure out whether it's symmetry in the theory on the quantum level, turns out that it's not. What's a bit different from this, but the two things are related. For example, these ABJ anomalies often appear, can be thought of as a Tufte anomalies, in the sense that you have some product gauge group, and this is a Tufte anomaly for the whole group, so that once you can gauge some subgroup, but then the other part of the group becomes a non-symmetry. Like, typical example, if you take, say, QED, massless QED in four dimensions, you have two U1s, the vector U1 and the axial U1, and if you promote, so there's a Tufte anomaly for this. So if you take the free fermion, you have the axial U1 and vector U1, and if you gauge the vector U1, you destroy the axial U1. So that's an example of ABJ anomaly, but it can also follow as a Tufte anomaly. There's a conflict of, you cannot gauge the whole U1 cross U1 in free theory. Anyway, from now on, I'm going to talk about the Tufte anomalies, so obstructions to gauging. Now, if G is some compact connected Lie group, then it's well known, this anomaly is well understood, and they arise already in theories of free fermions. So that was G. First assumption, if G is connected Lie group, then pretty much any Tufte anomaly comes from fermions. And there's a very easy way to describe all possible anomalies which can arise. It's known as this only happens in even dimensions. Well, D is a space-time dimension. And the reason is because somehow anomaly will only arise because of chirality in such theories. If your group acts differently on left-handed and right-handed fermions, that's when you can have anomaly. If it's left-right symmetric, there's no anomaly. And in odd dimensions, all the fermions are non-chiral anyway, so there's no room for anomalies in this kind of theories. Now, suppose we're in even dimensions, how do we describe possible anomalies? Well, I'm not going to talk about sort of local anomalies, not global anomalies. So which means that it's really talking about infinitesimal gauge transformations. Well, so in that case, we can classify this anomaly simply by saying that the variation of the action in the following way. You can say that anomalies in dimension D in one-to-one correspondence with Chern-Simons action in dimension d plus 1. So that makes sense because d is even, so d plus 1 is odd, so you're going to have Chern-Simons actions. Well, typical example, let's take in case of u1, you can easily write down this. This action in arbitrary dimension, say, in dimension d plus 1, it's like this. So, and the coefficient is must be an integer. Well, up to some normalization factor, it's an integer. So anomalies for free fermion, well, anomalies for group U1 in this free fermion theories are classified by essentially an integer. So because that's what, in what sense does this correspond to an anomaly? Well, you can say that, here I have an integration over some d plus one dimensional manifold. And you can ask, okay, suppose I vary this action on a manifold with a boundary, make a gauge variation. Then this action is not, it's gauge invariant on a closed manifold of d plus one dimensions, but on a manifold with a boundary, it's not. So its variation is a boundary term. Well, so in this case, it's just so the gauge symmetry, here acts just like this. And the boundary term is merely this. So I just integrated by parts here. And free fermion theory can have an anomaly such that if you vary the action, the effective action of free fermions on a d-dimensional manifold, its variation is going to be this. So in that sense, Chern-Simons theory in d plus one dimensions classifies anomalies for free fermions. Now it turns out that for continuous groups, actually that's all there is. That is, for connected compact Lie groups, this is the most general form anomaly. Well, if it's non-abelian, you need to use non-abelian Chern-Simons section, but that's the only general anomaly. So you can essentially realize any toothed anomaly by free fermions for the case of connected Lie group. Now, in the opposite case, and when case when G is completely disconnected, just a finite group. So it seems like it should be a simpler case, actually. Actually, in the case of free fermions, it doesn't actually present anything new. So if you ask, suppose I have some system of fermions, maybe some interacting with some scalar or something else, and the interactions break the symmetry down to some finite subgroup. So is the symmetry, does it have a toothed anomaly or not? Well, somehow the answer in this case is can be obtained from the case of a continuous group, simply because we have free fermions, any symmetry should preserve the kinetic term of the fermion. So if for free fermions, G is naturally a subgroup of some UN, some the unitary group which acts on the fermions, and we just simply embed this in the UN, compute the anomaly there, and then restrict that resulting anomaly that is to the subgroup. So it might happen that it turned out to be zero for some reason. And then it might be that UN is, the UN is anomalous, but its subgroup G is not anomalous. So it's a simple case. Suppose G is Z mod N. Then it's naturally, you can realize simply by single fermion, complex fermion. So it naturally thought of as a subgroup of U1. And then in that case, turns out that anomalies have a similar classification. You write U1 action. Let me call this actually P or K instead of N, because N is already in the gauge group. So that's an anomaly, but turns out that, K is, it's an integer, but turns out if K is divisible by N, actually it's a trivial expression. So the point is that, here A is a U1 gauge field, but really you want to think of it as a Z mod N gauge field, which means there are some constraints on this gauge field. And I'll come back to this later, but it turns out that K is identified with K plus N. So anomalies for free fermions with group Z mod N, a toothed anomaly is labeled by elements of Z mod N. Now the question is, in particular in odd dimensions, that would vanish identically. So again, because there's simply no Chern-Simons sections in even dimensions. However, it turns out that this is not the only way to get anomalies. That is, chiral fermion is not the only way to get anomalies. There's a totally different mechanism to get anomalies which works in arbitrary number of dimensions. In particular, with this more general mechanism, you can get anomaly of a discrete symmetry in purely bosonic theory and also in odd dimensions. So the reason, one way to let's say more general anomalies. I mean, first of all, anomalies can appear in dimension for discrete symmetries can appear in dimensions where there are no Chern-Simons sections at all, like even dimensions, or even in dimensions. Even in odd dimensions where there are Chern-Simons sections in one dimension higher, The general anomaly is actually not described by Chern-Simons action. So you can have more complicated anomalies. And moreover, anomalies can exist in bosonic theories. With D odd, and for even D, there exist anomalies not of Chern-Simons form. So I'd like to explain how these such anomalies arise. So the main idea is that what can replace for bosonic theories, what takes the role of chiral fermions? Well, it plays the role of chiral fermions are topological terms in the action. More specifically, the examples we're going to talk about are, we have some gauge theories in D dimensions, and gauge theories might have a topological term in the action, and those topological terms in the action somehow cause anomaly. That's one way to think about this. Another way to think about it, sort of overlapping, is that anomalies may arise from sort of some conflict between the way your global symmetry acts on electric and magnetic excitations in the theory. So you have some, say, in three dimensions, your both electric and magnetic excitations are, say, particles, and they can transform in some representations of your symmetry group. And then it turns out that this representation should be incompatible, so you won't be able to. That's the reason which you can't gauge this global symmetry. So it's still fine as a global symmetry, but not as a gauge symmetry. This sort of words, but these two explanations, they don't seem to be the same, but they sort of arise in a special case of some general formulas, which I'm going to explain how to derive. The simplest way to see that something is, there should be more general anomalies, more general than the Fermion anomalies, is the following. So for finite G, the analog of Chern-Simons theory is Diagraph-Witten theory. So this is a certain topological theory which can write down for in any dimension for any finite gauge group G, which is in some sense analogous to Chern-Simons theory and or the class of theories. So how does it work? Well, it's actually unlike Chern-Simons theory, which can write a continuum action. Diagraph-Witten theory in general cannot be so easily described in a continuum. We have to use a lattice description. For some specific gauge groups, you can actually write a continuum action as well. And maybe I'll have time to explain that, but for now, let me just think of it as a lattice theory. So in the lattice theory, the way you think about, you have triangulations, you have space-time, and when you describe gauge theory, you describe it using some variables living on links on one simplices, and each variable lives in this finite group G, and for every two simplex, this very triangle, you have a constraint. So you have I need to choose a direction of arrows. So and then the constraint, it says that there's one constraint for every two simplex, which looks like this. So this is a described configuration space of your model, or your lattice model. So you have G valued variables in every link and constraint for every two simplex. And then you sum over all these configurations and assign to each configuration a weight. Well, so Diagraph and Witten showed in in 89, 91, that all possible choices of weights, which give you a topological theory, have a simple description So if you're in dimension, space-time dimension D, weights are labeled by cohomology of the classifying space of the group G. So so what is this classifying space? Well, just for any group, you can have, finite or not finite, have a classifying space of principal G bundles. So that, that is that some, it's typically some infinite dimensional space such that G bundles on any topological space can be thought of as maps from that space to the classifying space. Say you have a group, say Z2, so G is Z2. Then even for this simple group, BG is infinite dimensional, it's RP infinity. And say for GU1, it's CP infinity. So now this is classifying space of G bundles. Now, for continuous groups, actually, there are several different types of classifying space you can think about. It's a classifying space of principal G bundles. You can think about classifying space for bundles with a connection. You can think about classifying space of bundles with a flat connection. They're all different spaces. So there are several versions of this. Say this one is classifying space of just G bundles with no extra data. But for finite groups, that's a big simplification. There's only one classifying space because it's all the same. All connections are flat anyway because it's a finite group, and specifying a connection is the same as specifying a bundle. Basically, there's no difference. So luckily, we can just forget about the distinction for defined groups and just look at BG. This is a unique BG we can talk about.
So that formula works for continuous group or only for finite group?
That's only for Dirac-Witten theory, which are only for finite groups.
I see. But for continuous group, what is the result?
For continuous groups, the correct classifying... For continuous groups, the correct classifying space in that context would be the classifying space of G bundles with flat connections, not this one. Okay. So anyway, but I'm not going to use that approach for continuous groups, just for finite groups. Finite groups is a unique choice. Okay, so I'm not going to describe how this weight is constructed. Let me just say that it's, well, what is a cocycle for the classifying space? Well, it turns out there's a way to think about this cocycle as some function of d variables with values in u1. And a cocycle condition is some constraint on this function of this d variables. And there's some trivial solutions called coboundaries and equation by those. And that's how you define this cohomology group.
Well, with so for finite group, it is h of d bg u1 is like equivalent to h of d g u1, right?
Sorry?
You use bg classifying space here. But yeah, for a finite group, you can also just use g, right? It's the same.
People thing. Often call this like this, but just notation is a notation. It's the same as group cohomology. It's just the same, not just equivalent. They're literally the same thing. When people write this, they really mean, but when I say write H, I mean the usual cohomology, like singular, whatever. So this, when the space is BG, people often call it group cohomology and have this notation. But since I also want to think about sometimes about continuous groups, I don't want to confuse cohomology with topological space versus cohomology with classifying space. I don't want to use this notation at all. Okay, so, but it's the same thing. Notation. So, okay, so this is the analog of Chern-Simons theory, which exists in every dimension, like Chern-Simons theory. That's already an interesting fact. And, well, whether it exists or not, of course, depends on the source of the group. Sometimes, you know, it exists, and does, sometimes it's just this group, whole group can simply be zero. But anyway, so the point is that if that's the case, you can imagine that anomalies for this finite group, finite symmetry group G. In dimension D, I labeled by so anomalies for G, which now is assumed to be finite in dimension D. Maybe a one-to-one correspondence, perhaps, with D plus one dimensional cohomology group. And the idea is, again, that, you know, in what sense anomaly is classified by this, by the Diagraph-Witten theory. Well, I'll just say that, again, imagine that your space on which your field theory lives is a boundary of some d plus one dimensional space. And there is some theory living in the bulk, namely Diagraph-Witten theory. Now, Diagraph-Witten theory has a gauge invariant action for closed d plus one dimensional manifold. But if there's a boundary, again, the variation of the action has a boundary term. And you say that, you know, that's a natural candidate for the anomaly for of the d-dimensional theory. That is, natural guess is that an anomaly in d plus one dimensions, so in d dimensions, can be canceled by some anomaly inflow, by anomaly of the d plus one dimensional Diagraph-Witten theory. Just like in continuous groups, Chern-Simons theory provides natural bulk for your d-dimensional anomalous theory. Okay, so, yeah.
I just wanted to say whether you know any example that the boundary type, boundary anomaly of a d-dimensional space-time can come from like extend bulk, which is not just d plus one, maybe d plus two.
Actually, we'll see examples that, that's actually wrong. So indeed, if you have a d plus one dimensional Diagraph-Witten theory, then on the boundary, you have to have a theory with an anomaly. But on the other hand, not all anomalies arise in this way. That is, sometimes a theory can have such a severe anomaly that it cannot be canceled by normal inflow from the d plus one dimensional bulk. So there are examples like that. I don't know if they can be canceled by higher dimensional guys or not, but for sure, certainly there are some anomalies which are more severe than this.
Can you just name it?
I'll give it later. Yeah. Give it later. Okay. So, let's see. So let me now, well, based on this, you can already predict that some theories in odd dimensions can have anomalies, something which is impossible for fermions. Well, for example, if that's, well, let's say, let G be Zn cross Zn. And then say H 4 of BG in this case is also like this. And which means that on the boundary of such four-dimensional lattice model, you're supposed to have a bosonic, well, you must have some sort of bosonic theory with an atroph anomaly for this symmetry. And the theory must have the boundary theory is anomalous and it's three-dimensional. So that's something which is not possible in the fermionic theory of free fermions. Okay. Now you can also, another interesting observation is the following. So suppose, just to illustrate that if this is correct, then the anomalies are more general than the free fermion anomalies. Suppose, product of several Z-modems. And so yeah, so in general, we have several Zn. So you have, well, okay, you can look at maybe even, okay, so we have, say, H, you know, gauge H4. Well, let's actually look at two dimensional case. So H3, say, of BG, one. So you can have, well, let's just look at some special case, like Z mod n, 3 Z mod n. So, yes?
Anomaly
I guess you could say that, yeah. So the way, well, we'll see how I write the action if you respond to this. In some sense, I guess it vanishes, yes. But it's kind of tricky to think about this discrete. I'm not sure in what sense that for any finite n, you still have non-trivial fields, which are not U1, flat U1 fields, something like that. So you have a flat field, which flat Z mod n fields, which doesn't lead to a flat U1 field. So that's basically the mechanism for where the anomalies arise. Well, anyway, so if in two dimensions, you're supposed to look at H3. So in this case, you have a term. Well, so there's a term here which involves a cross term of all three guys. So there's an action which involves all an action made out of these gauge fields for these three Zn's, which involves all three Zn gauge fields. There's a term here, which looks like H1 of BZn U1 cube. It's a cubic sort of anomaly, which involves all three gauge fields. Now, for free fermions, that's not possible. So for the anomalies in theories of free fermions, at most, well, those quadratic in the gauge fields. So there's no like term with only three gauge fields. That's again something which only exists because the anomalies, the group is discrete. Okay, so once we know, okay, so let me now explain how these anomalies arise and give examples. So both my examples are going to be in three dimensions. So the relevant group will going to be H4. But actually, we'll see that the anomalies, well, the anomalies are they're more general than what I said so far. The anomalies cannot be canceled by dagger Whitten theories. I want to talk about dimension 2 and dimension 4. Well, dimension 1 is kind of trivial, so we don't discuss it in the papers, even though there are anomalies there too, in some sense. And the reason I'm talking about dimension 3, because there are two different kinds of, well, okay, so I'm going to realize anomalies. Well, an idea is that anomalies arise in the following situation. That's true in any dimension. Anomalies arise when you have a non-trivial, anomalies for global symmetry can arise when you have a gauge symmetry group. So we have a somehow total symmetry group, and there's a subgroup made of gauge symmetries. And then, the global symmetry group is the quotient of the total symmetry by the gauge symmetry. So I write this as an exact sequence. So if you don't like exact sequences, although I think you should, so then G is G hat quotient. So it is a normal subgroup of total symmetry group, but in general, this extension is non-trivial. And anomalies can arise when this, when this extension is non-trivial only. So that's the idea for this mechanism. So we have a gauge group and maybe some topological action for the gauge field living in D. And then when you try to gauge G, you want to promote a topological action from an action just which is defined for D-valued gauge field to the whole G hat, and that may turn out to be impossible. So it's a sort of classical sort of extension problem. So you, in general, enlarging a topological term from the subset of D-valued gauge field to the subset of G hat-valued gauge field may turn out to be impossible. That's the mechanism for obstruction, and that's what I call a Hooft anomaly.
Why you need another group involved? I mean, if you have a gauge group, you say, okay, what is anomaly for this gauge group?
No, I don't want to. I have a non-anomalous gauge group. I have a true anomalous gauge group means your theory is sick, just throw it out.
Okay.
I have a global symmetry group. And I also have a well-defined gauge symmetry. So So they have well-defined theory.
I see. So you have a combination of a gate symmetry and the global symmetry together.
Yeah, so some of the conflict between their desire to gauge G and the fact that relations in G only hold up to elements of D, that's what it means to have an untrivial extension. So relations between elements of G don't close on the node, but only up to elements of the gauge group, if you act on your fields. And okay, a priori, that doesn't necessarily lead to obstruction. That's not, not nearly enough to cause an anomaly. So you need to have something else. And what you need to have, for example, is some sufficiently non-trivial topological action for the D-value gauge field. Or alternatively, you can, the action might be trivial, the topological action might be trivial, but you have a freedom, we'll see, to somehow specify, suppose you have a freedom to specify how your G-symmetry acts on electric and magnetic excitations. Now, it might be fine by itself, but when you try to gauge the theory, gauge this G, then it might be a problem if you're the way the G acts on electric and magnetic excitations is incompatible, not suitable for gauging. Now, this idea was, you know, this was, I think it's well, clearly stated first time in work of Sentil and Vishwanath on bosonic topological insulators. That's where they actually the impetus for this work came from. We're trying to understand on the, from field theory how this projectiveness of the action of G, that's how they formulate it, say that G acts projectively on the fields, how that causes anomaly. In some sense, this mechanism, unlike the free fermion case, is, relies on interactions because this topological term can sort of a sort of interaction for the gauge fields, so intrinsically interacting mechanism. Now, the reason I like to discuss this, well, 3D case, okay, so I'd like to discuss the 3D case is actually there are two different kinds of topological gauge theories in 3D, and there is the Dyagraph-Witten theories and there are Chern-Simons theories, and they're not, well, there's some overlapping case, which some theories can be thought of in either way, but in general, they're distinct. And we sort of figured out how to compute this anomaly in both kinds of theories. And in other dimensions, you don't have, well, say in two dimensions, you don't have Dyagraph-Witten theories. And in four dimensions, you also don't have Chern-Simons theories. So in some sense, 3D case is the most interesting one. The Dyagraph-Witten case works in a similar way in all dimensions.
Yeah. Here corresponds to T here.
Well, okay. When I say that I want to choose some sort of gauge theory for gauge group D. Now, again,
but the T in
Dyagraph-Witten
is a
gauge
theory.
Well, G
in but the T in Dyagraph-Witten model is a gauge theory.
Yes, but I'm not,
so that's correct.
I'm not there yet. So I'm in D dimensions. And I haven't decided yet. I don't know yet whether the anomaly can or cannot be canceled by inflow from one dimension higher. So I don't know yet what the anomaly is classified by. So there's no Dyagraph-Witten theory for G yet. I don't have that yet. I hope, and that actually not turns out to be true in general, that anomaly can be canceled by inflow from Dyagraph-Witten theory with gauge group G. And sometimes it's true, sometimes it isn't. For now, I'm looking at D gauge theory. And there I might have Dyagraph-Witten action for this D gauge field, or maybe Chern-Simons action or something else. It should be something non-trivial. Well, okay. It's a good way to go with anomalies to assume that this action is non-trivial. Okay. Now, but actually, Dyagraph-Witten case in some sense is easier because for Dyagraph-Witten theory, there's a good classification of actions in terms of group cohomology, like for D. And this extension problem can be made very precise. So suppose D is finite. So, and the action is of Dyagraph-Witten type. Just to get a feel for what to expect. Okay. So then what's the problem? So that case, well, okay. So first of all, in this theory, there's some gauge field, which takes values in this finite group D, and maybe some matter as well. So the matter, well, it's not particularly important, but your gauge group G acts on the matter fields, and this action might close only up to elements of this gauge group. And that's sort of what forces you on this non-trivial extension. But the matter itself doesn't play that much role. But anyway, so suppose I have some action. So this action is labeled, essentially it's labeled by this element omega in HD now of BD with U1 coefficients. And if I fix a class of my extension, that is I fix essentially G hat. So then somehow I want to extend this to say called omega hat. So I want to extend it to a diagraph with, well, if this is finite, this is finite, then G hat is also finite. And the actions for these finite groups are labeled by similar cohomology group. Okay. And well, so it works as well, if you have this map from D to G hat, we have a map from D to G hat. There's a corresponding map of classifying spaces. If you wish, you can think about BD as some subspace of this BG hat. And if you have a cohomology class for BG hat, you can of course restrict it to the subspace or pull back if you wish by this map. That's an embedding. However, what you want to do is somehow the opposite. You want to take class here and somehow get it as a restriction of something here. That may not be possible. There's an obstruction. There might be an obstruction for that. You cannot want to extend it, cohomology class, from a subspace to the whole space. Well, the abstraction theory for this is well known. And this problem is described by some spectral sequence. So I don't like spectral sequences, even though probably I should. But we'll see that it doesn't tell you a priori all that much, in the sense that all these abstractions, you can sort of classify them using this spectral sequence, but you can't actually compute anything. And if you want to compute things, it's actually better to do it the physical way. So, and so that's how we did it. But anyway, so if you just look at the spectral sequence, it tells you that there's actually a sequence of abstractions. And the first actually lives here. And then there is a, if this abstraction vanishes, so the abstraction doesn't live where we thought it's supposed to live. The abstraction is supposed to be the anomaly, but the anomaly is supposed to in HD plus one dimensional cohomology class of BG, not this creature. But anyway, so now the leading abstraction actually lives here. And then if it vanishes, then you need to study the next abstraction, which is here. And if that vanishes and so forth, you study. And the last one, is well, there you have H naught of BD with U on cushions, is just U1. Okay, so that's that mathematically what happens when you study the subtraction theory. So the last one is the one we expected. So basically what happens is this, when you try to gauge your symmetry G, you want to try to cancel, well, you hope to cancel the anomaly if you have, well, so if all the obstructions vanish, except the last, well, if all obstructions vanish, you can actually, the series is not anomalous, you can gauge G. If the last obstruction doesn't, if all obstructions vanish except the last one, the theory is anomalous, but you can cancel the anomaly by anomaly in the flow from D plus one dimensions. But if any of the previous ones doesn't vanish, then you cannot even do that. So that's the expectations. So, and let me give an example. Instead of trying to be general, let me give an example. So, let me show how this abstraction is going to be computed. So, our dimension is going to be 3. And I take the group to be, well, in this case, just take Z mod n. Actually, wait. And my group G is going to be. Well, it doesn't matter what it is. G is just some finite group. Okay. Well, the simplest example, actually. And we want, of course, well, as I said, emphasize that the whole mechanism comes from the, having a non-trivial extension. So extensions are possible extensions are labeled by this cohomology group. In this case, D is Z mod N. So you want this not to be vanishing. Well, for example, simplest example which works is take Zn cross Zn. In which case, so okay. So suppose we have set up actually non-abortable G's. We just find a group with some extension class. We need to pick the extension class. So what is the action we're going to choose? Well, you could just choose a trivial action for this Zn gauge theory, or you can choose non-trivial. Let's be general. So the action for this 3D theory, well, actually has a sort of Chern-Simons-like form. So now I want to, instead of being abstract, the reason I specified this case is because, you know, this Dijkgraaf-Witten theory for a general finite group is some sort of nebulous thing. You need to use some cohomology class for which you don't have an explicit construction. But for Z mod N gauge group, we can actually write down a very simple action on the lattice, which is really clear what to do with it. So that is, even though abstractly, okay, abstractly you would say, well, action should be classified by this cohomology group, and that's known to be Z mod N. So you need to have some parameter in the action which takes values in the integers modulo N. Now, that's this integer is this K. Now, what is the meaning of this action? Well, first of all, I'm still working in the lattice because it's a finite gauge group on a triangulation. And A is a one cachain on this triangulation. Well, let's call it M. This whole space is M, but it's triangulated. So now it's a one cachain with values in Z mod N principle, but it's convenient to think about it as a Z valued cachain, as integer valued. The reason it's convenient because, well, for Z mod N valued cachain, I have a condition that it's closed, right? So on every triangle, I have like three values, like A1, A2, A3, and the, well, I write the group additively because it's Z mod N, and the condition will be like this. That condition there will be four will be like this. But if I write it as an integer valued guy, then it's zero modulo N. Uh-huh. More convenient to think about this way. So A is a, assigns an integer to every link in your lattice. That's what it means for it to be a one cochain. And it's closed, meaning this holds. Okay. So that is delta A is zero modulo N. But delta A is an integer to cochain, is not zero. That's what it's here. It's a simplicial differential, this A. So delta A is a two cochain. This is a one cochain. For cochains, we have a cup product, which is analogous to the wedge product in the continuum. So that's what, how the action is defined. It's integral of three cochain over this triangulation. Okay. So so the now, okay, so I want to gauge now this G. So how do we go about that? Well, first of all, how does G act on D? Well, how does my symmetry act on the gauge field? I assume that it doesn't. It wasn't necessary, actually. One can generalize the case when it does act non-trivially, just for simplicity. So G acts trivially on D, suppose it does. Doesn't mean that it acts trivially on everything. It acts, might, there are also matter fields. Yeah, but the matter fields, it acts in some way which is projective, that is, GX, G on, well, relations in G hold up to elements of D. And that's what determines that class. So the Hadron-Trial extension class. Not zero. So that's the only role of matter fields. I don't want to write them down. So how do we incorporate? Suppose I try to gauge this G now. What does it mean? Well, what it means is the following, that now I have, I suppose I have G hat gauge fields in the theory, which means I'm going to have this A, as before, which integer valued, and also going to have elements of G. And what does it mean for, well, I don't know yet what the action is going to be, but let me just think about what the effect of this extension is. Well, this well, the group is now is G hat, the gauge group, suppose it's G hat. So this whole, this guy is an element of G hat. And what does it mean for the action, for this to be well-defined configuration, first of all? Well, the product of all these three guys should be closed, should be zero in the group, which should be identity element in the group. But the product is not simply independent for A's and G. The group is an extension of G by D. So if you work out what this means, then the flatness condition. So let's suppose I call this whole thing, you know, this is A capital A, this is capital A, and that's capital A. So you know, the condition that the product of all three elements is one means that, first of all, inside G, you still have the usual relations, but as for A, it's not the usual relation. It's rather delta A is the this cocycle C evaluated on the gauge field G. Well, the usual relation would be, well, if I have this simply product of two. Yeah, so we have simply, if C is zero, then I'll just have just independent closeness relations for a G gauge field and the D gauge field. It would have like this condition and this condition. What instead you have is something like this. You have this sum is not equal to zero, but equal to C. Well, in detail, what this means is that that A1 plus A2 plus A3 is, well, a cocycle, two cocycles is a function of two variables, both living in G. So something like this is what you get in detail. It's a modified relation like that. Okay, so that's what it means to, well, so when you gauge G, your, first of all, your constraint is modified from this to this. Yes? Yeah, well, I don't need this argument. I just erase this. So, and I move there. So, well, and basically, now you need to, you're right, so when you gauge, what does it mean? So the gauged action, well, it must be the same action as before in the sense that you have this as before, but you also must have, first of all, deform the constraints, so delta is not what it used to be. It used to be zero modulo n, now it's actually, well, by the way, here, when I write that constraint on top, that's actually, again, modulo n, it's supposed to hold modulo n only. But then you also need to add terms which are depend on the background gauge field on this G. And well, you can write something like this. Must have some, well, we should call this background gauge field for GA. So you can add something like this. You might have term linear in A. So this term quadratic in A, but it can have terms depending on A, but depending also on the background gauge field. And you can also have terms like this, just depending on the background gauge field. So A is a collection of these G-valued variables. Okay, so that's how it works. And so what this, well, this should be a Tuco chain in Tuco chain on BG values in, well, this takes values in D, and that somehow should be taken value in the dual group, because when you contract them, you're supposed to get an element of U1 or integers module, well, R module integers. We live here. And this guy should be just some Fricker chain on BG. Okay, and then you need to, of course, the constraint, the main constraint is should be gauge invariant. And we work out what this means. It turns out that the following, that is, you want the gauge variation of this thing to be, first of all, you want it to be independent of the little a. So this, when you, okay, so you want it to be zero, but the first step is to, whatever variation of this is independent of the little a. The first step is to enforce the condition that the variation of this action is little a independent. And once you got that, hopefully you can choose arrange this by choosing this B of A suitably. And once you enforce that, then you can choose this omega to perhaps cancel all the whole terms in the variation, including, well, even little a independent ones. Turns out this procedure precisely corresponds to this special sequence argument that I told you before. Like special sequence, we had this first guy lives, there are several terms, but the one, okay, so the really leading one would be this one. That's the leading obstruction in this, according to the special sequence, but that actually vanishes here because this happens to vanish. So we have no hope to get that, but the next one, well, that's actually takes values in the precisely in H3 of BG of Z mod n. That actually is non-zero. And if it doesn't vanish, you actually cannot cancel. Even you cannot arrange B of A so that you cancel terms which are in variation which are A dependent. And this obstruction is the following thing. So we have this leading obstruction. Is the following thing. You take this C. Well, C is a close. Well, it lives here. Now it means that it's Tuco cycle modulo n, so which means that it's closed if you think of it as an integer valued guy, it's closed modulo n. But if you lift it to an actual integer valued guy, it's not necessarily closed modulo n. So delta C, maybe some cochain, let's call it gamma of C, and it lives in C3 of B G Z. The leading obstruction says that 2k times this gamma c is 0 modulo n. So what that is, this is a leading obstruction. If it doesn't vanish modulo n, you're dead in the sense that you cannot cancel, the theory is not anomalous. It's anomalous. You cannot, and moreover, you cannot cancel the anomaly using Diagraph-Witten one dimension higher. And it leaves where it's supposed to leave, right? It leaves precisely in that group here. So note, by the way, that this somehow for the case when n is 2, which is very common in kind of meta literature, is actually special, because in that case, it is just vanished identically. This 2 just happens to sit there and make it trivial. But in general, for like Z3 symmetries, it's non-vanish. So, and the subleading obstruction, so suppose it vanishes, so I can define subleading obstruction. Well, in that case, well, suppose it vanishes, meaning the following, that I can write this. Well, when I say vanishes, okay, I should have said, oh, in cohomology. I can write this guy as a delta of something. Would be not. And B naught, it's a cachain on BG with values in Z mod n. Okay. And subleading obstruction turns out that it's a variation of this action vanishes if and don't leave the following. Well, there's a condition which has the following, the delta of this omega, the last term. The action must be equal, that's a condition that it, of Gaussian invariance, must be equal to this, where C tilde is this, well, basically this, but regarded not modulo n, but an integral cochain. Well, for this to work, of course, the cohomology of this must be trivial. Otherwise, you can solve this equation. So, that's a subleading obstruction. And if it does not vanish, the theory has a 12th anomaly still. And if it does, well, by the way, it can be canceled by Dagger-Witten theory in four dimensions. So one can give some examples of uncancelled anomalies of various kinds. Let me just state what they are. Examples. D. Well, simplest ones probably take Z2 gauge theory. And you want to consider a symmetry like the Z2 cross Z2. So in this case, this first obstruction actually always vanishes because, you know, 2 times anything is 0 modulo 2, right? Modulo 2. So no. Leading obstruction vanishes. Well, just computed. Yeah, it's good. Well, just computed. Yeah, that's where 2 comes from. So in this case, you can always, for Z2 gauge theory, you can always cancel anomaly by Dagger-Witten theory in one dimension higher. So. But this might be a non-trivial theory, that is, you have a total anomaly in 3 dimensions. So, well, in this case, so k can be 0 or 1. So, of course, if k is 0, there's nothing. So, you know, sorry. Suppose, so in this case, B naught doesn't have to be trivial, but can be, well, it doesn't have to be trivial. It just must be closed. So, B naught is a special element in H2 of BG with B1 Zn coefficients. And but C also lives there. And the obstruction just becomes a Hooft anomaly, just this. Well, it's basically, you can see from there. So even if you have trivial topological theory in 3D, just if k vanishes, this term might still be non-zero. What's the physical meaning of this? Well, C tells you that electric excitations transform projectively under your symmetry group G, which is like Z2 cross Z2 here. Well, actually, what is non-trivial here? Well, for example, you can have an extension like this, where G hat is with dihedral group of order 8. So, like when you have like generators, say X, Y, Z, or X and Y for this Z2 and Z here. And the relations are like this, X squared equals to 1, Y squared is equals to 1, and XY equals Z, YX instead of just YX. It's a non-trivial extension. Suppose your excitations transform like this, under this, the representation of D8. Well, it basically means that you realize one generator, X, you can use two bosonic fields, for example. For one of them, X is like this. For another one, for, well, so, and Y is like this. And, you know, the anticommutative sort of commuting. So that leads to a non-trivial central, non-trivial extension of Z2 cross Z2 by Z2. Okay, so. Sorry?
The quotient. G hat by Z2, isn't it Z4? Is it Z2 per Z2?
No, it's Z2. So,
the dihedral group is corresponding to Z2 by Z4, right? Okay. And the quotient on the right hand side.
So Z. It's order 8, sorry. I don't know how which notation is for D8, sorry. There are two notations for dihedral groups, and one of them says that Dn has n elements, and one says it's 2n elements, well, n over 2.
Has 8
elements. Yes, yeah.
So the quotient must have 4 elements.
It does.
Isn't it cyclic group of order 4? I mean,
no. You can also have another one extension.
Yeah. Oh, okay, so you're.
There's also quaternionic group of order 8. That's another extension. You can have like x squared is equals to minus 1, y squared equals to minus 1, and this. That also works, by the way. So it doesn't matter which one you choose. Just like a different action of Z2 cross Z2. Anyway, so if you just take any of these two guys, that describes how matter fields transform, and that transforms some non-trivial C. But you can take B to be the same thing, or it's a different thing. For example, you can take, say, for electric excitations, this kind of extension class, and for magnetic one, this kind of extension class. And their product is non-vanishing, so which means there's an obstruction in this case. There's no conflict with electric and magnetic excitations. You can also add, suppose your electric guys transform like either of these guys, the magnetic one just trivial. In that case, anomaly can still be non-vanishing, because this vanishes, but if you have non-trivial topological action for the gauge field itself, then again, you have an anomaly. So, that's probably the simplest example of an anomalous theory in three dimensions. Take just Z2 gauge theory, take two bosonic fields on which Z2 cross Z2 acts like this, and postulate that your action for Z2 gauge field is non-trivial, that is, K is 1 rather than 0. Well, that theory is anomalous. You cannot gauge that Z2 cross Z2. So this is a similar thing for Chern-Simons theories. I don't want to describe that. But I just want to say that if you instead replace Z2 cross Z2 with Zn cross Zn, say Zp cross Zp, some prime p, then already for p equals 3, the leading obstruction is also in general non-trivial. Like if you generalize this for just replacing this example, you know, take Zp cross Zp for some prime p, which is not 2, and take k to be not 0 modulo p, then this obstruction is non-zero. So the theory, the anomaly is so severe, you cannot cancel with Dagger-Whitten type theory in one dimension higher. So, similar things happen in Chern-Simons theories. So the method is basically the same. You just write an action. Now it has to be in the continuum because Chern-Simons theory is defined in the continuum. But then you add, you can write similar terms which couple your background gauge field, which you try to couple your theory to a background gauge field for G, you write all possible terms that you can possibly have in the continuum and try to choose the coefficients of the action's gauge invariant. Turns out there are abstractions for doing that. And in general, they're not just Dijkstra-Friedman type abstractions. Well, the sequence of abstractions. And the story is basically the same in all dimensions, except well, for Dijkstra-Friedman theories, which exist in all dimensions, you always have this stuff. So just I want to stop here. I just want to say that you can also have these are pretty anomalies of internal symmetries. Like when you have, say, time reversal symmetry, which is also important from various perspectives, you can generalize this too by essentially by the simplest way to do that is just to say that you're gauging a time reversal symmetry. If your G contains time reversal, gauging is like allowing your theory to be defined on unorientable manifolds. And the role of the background gauge field for G then is played by the first Stifel-Whitney class. And then you basically follow the same strategy. You just write your action for some gauge theory with gauge group D, but when you gauge time reversal, orientation reversal, you add all possible terms which depend on the original gauge field and also the Stifel-Whitney class W1. And then you try to arrange so that the action is well defined, invariant all the symmetries and in general the abstractions. So that's natural generalization. And that generalization to the case of continuous G, not continuous D, because continuous D is not really a problem, but continuous G is trickier because basically you need to do the same thing, but you have to say that your, well, in principle, we know the answer in that case because, as I say, for continuous G, you have this Chern-Simons formulation, which is very simple, but you don't really need to use this formalism. But really, you should, when you generalize continuous symmetries, the idea is to, you need to use field, which is flat, but not necessarily gauge equivalent to zero. Right? So you can have flat, say, U1 gauge field, which is not trivial. So, and you need to, when you gauge it, you just basically write all possible terms, which depend on the original gauge field and the flat U1 gauge field, say. And that's how you can compute the anomaly in this example as well.
Well, if there are no questions, let's thank Anton again.